I'll call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Public Safety. Colleagues, today is March 11th, 2015. Convened for a public hearing continuance on Senate Bill 5533, the budget bill of the Public Defense Services Commission. Mr. Bender, anything that we should know for the good of the order?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Please note that the agency will be continuing their presentation that is found in OLIS under yesterday's meeting date. We also have some written testimony today that's been submitted under today's date. But I believe that Director Cosine is going to be coming up to introduce the material and the speakers for today.
Welcome back, Director.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Shields, members of the subcommittee. Again, Nancy Cosine, Executive Director at the Office of Public Defense Services. We are going to go slightly out of order today because we actually have quite a bit of public testimony to get through today. So rather than going through all of our budget slides today, what I'd like to do is actually start with one of our Eastern County providers who actually has a long drive ahead of him after his testimony. Then we'll share with you a little bit about our appellate division and our KPMs. And then I'd like to take the rest of the time to make sure we have an opportunity to hear from our invited guests and public testimony. And if we have to push something into tomorrow, I will cover the rest of the budget slides tomorrow, if that's all right with the committee.
So would you like to do the public testimony first and then do your portion after if we have time?
I need to get the appellate division portion in, okay, and then mine, yes, if all that's all right with the committee.
It's fine with me. Fire away.
Thank you. So I'd like to ask Rob Rascio to come up. You can go.
Okay.
And I wanted to give you a little bit of background. You heard our chair yesterday mention that one of the challenges we face in public defense is attracting new providers to the arena, and particularly more recent graduates. This is more the case in Eastern Oregon than anywhere. It's not as big a problem in Multnomah County as it is in Eastern Oregon. And so we asked Mr. Rascio to come and talk to you a little bit about his experience in Eastern Oregon. And we have a map of the state so that some of his comments will resonate with you. You can see the distances that he's traveling to get his work accomplished. And I wanted to mention that he's new to this region, this contract cycle. And we told you yesterday we do a survey every year to judges and system partners in different in every jurisdiction. And I am really proud of the comments that we've gotten back from the Grant and Harney region where Mr. Rascio is practicing. And so I'll share two of them with you. One, from Judge Kramer, it's getting better all the time out here as these attorneys become more and more qualified. Another, having multiple attorneys in both Grant and Harney County's offices has made an improvement in both the quality of representation and the timeliness of court proceedings. This is a jurisdiction where we previously had one provider, and we've really made a strong effort to try and increase our services there. So with that, Mr. Rascio.
Welcome to the committee, Rob.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Shields. Members of the committee, my name again is Rob Rascio. I work in Canyon City, Oregon, which is on this side, the middle red dot. My district runs, I'm in the 24th Judicial District, which runs between Grant and Harney counties. We have a single judge that provides for both of those counties, so I'll be getting to that. I took over in January of 2014 for the retiring Mark Usario, who was the public defender there for 14 years and represented individuals accused of crimes with distinction. Prior to that, I worked for 7.5 years in the Dalles, which is that dot. The Dalles, Oregon, with the law firm ran by Jack Morris, who's presented before this committee a number of times in the past. And prior to that, I was in Burns again and then back in Canyon City where I got my start. Many of the issues I'll address today are similar for the firm that I was in the Dalles and also in Harney County, and similar for most of the providers in my region. We have a difficult time recruiting and retaining associates. In particular, based upon their skyrocketing student loan obligations. We have huge distances to travel between judicial districts that require mileage reimbursements that come out of the contracts. And, of course, maintaining competitive benefits for employees, as we are private employers. We are small businesses. We do not have the benefit of PERS or other obligations like that that would assist us. I work for a I run now as a small business a private law firm in Oregon, which provides indigent defense services. Same way as other private businesses contract with the state to build roads, to provide engineering designs, or fight wildland fires. A significant number of law firms in Oregon contract with the state to provide indigent defense services. In real terms, private law firms and consortia, which consist generally of small private firms or solo practitioners collected in a group to provide services for a region, is an important sector of the providers for indigent defense services in Oregon, providing 63.7% of the caseload coverage in the state last year. This important model does not mean that we don't receive any state benefits such as PERS. The model also allows us to provide other legal services to our respective communities, which is becoming an ongoing concern as the bar grays not only in the indigent defense community, as pointed out by Mr. Ellis yesterday, but in rural communities generally. Judge Kramer in the 24th Judicial District where I practice has expressed concerns about this on a number of occasions, and about 50% of the bar in our judicial district is on the verge of retirement, which has a deep impact on legal services to a small community. The truth is it's very hard to recruit young lawyers to more rural parts of the state. Mr. Saria was unable to recruit an associate for over 8 years to Grant County. I got lucky. I was able to find two young lawyers to come work for me. My wife knew one and invited him out, and he said yes because she's persuasive. And the other knew an associate of Mr. Lamborn's down in Harney County. With the gracious agreement and assistance of the PDSC and my agreement to handle additional cases in Baker City, the second dot on the far end there,
yeah.
I was able to hire both. And I don't think the recruitment will be as easy next time for a number of reasons, some of which I'll outline for you now. Both of my associates came to my firm with extensive student loan debts, for which there's no forgiveness under federal law because we're a private firm and not public defenders. Each of them came with accumulated debt of over $150,000. Based upon their salaries and therefore the federal guidelines for affordability, both of them are paying about $400 a month towards their debt. That $400 does not even cover the interest they're accruing each year on those loans. The current payment is a substantial portion of their monthly budget, and they're being paid what the PDSC contract will bear for their salaries. Without income-based payment plans, one would be paying $1,214 a month, and the other would be paying $1,644 a month against their debt obligations. This is an Oregon problem, too, because they went to school out of state. In Oregon, I worked with an associate up in the Dalles who went to Oregon State University for undergraduate and the University of Oregon for law school. When he got out of school, he had an accumulated debt in 2014 of $120,000. That's in comparison to my debt load in 2001 when I graduated from the U of O after attending Portland State University of $60,000. So you can see that the costs of education are increasing rapidly. Each associate is being trained by the standards required by PDSC, which are rigorous and ensure individuals charged with offenses get adequate and zealous representation. In rural Oregon, we represent at the trial level, individuals charged with a myriad of different offenses and circumstances. We represent individuals charged with shoplifting gum up to kidnapping. We represent children who are taken into the Department of Human Services custody and their parents. We represent the alleged mentally ill, people who are charged with probation violations, contempt, and extradition proceedings. It requires a lot of training, which is something that we have to do out of our budgets. We're lucky in Oregon to have the services, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, run by Mr. Potter, that offers us a great, John Potter, which offers us a great number of resources to do that, but still it is an administrative cost. The other administrative cost that we're running into is the ever-rising health care costs for my four employees, myself, and my children, which puts pressure on the financial health of my organization, as does retirement plans and wage increases to remain competitive. Allow me to say this. To be clear, we are not competitive in the legal market. love of our Constitution and its promise of freedom from tyranny is often the driving factor in these young people's willingness to work at our rates of pay. Generally, idealism that drives them to the work is replaced over time with realism of family and finances, and they have to leave our work that they are well suited to better paying jobs. And that is a loss to every community that these young people work in, and it is a problem that this legislature can help us solve. The final factor I wanted to share with you is the significant impact on my small business's budget related to work-related travel. Over the last year, I personally have traveled 10,500 miles on PDSC business. That's a 140-mile round trip from Canyon City down to Burns and back, or from 162 miles from Baker City to Canyon City and back, similar to Gold Beach to Coquille or Medford to Klamath Falls. The travel is unavoidable. It's important that a lawyer be present with a client during important phases of their criminal cases and other types of cases, and we make it a point to do that. 5 hours of travel in a day is a long day. Another way to translate the 10,500 miles is I spent 175 hours in my car last year doing this work. The work we do is very important for the stability of our democracy and to ensure the guarantees of our Constitution, and I'm grateful to be able to do the work and serve liberty and my fellow citizens. And I thank each of you for your support of the PDSC and ask you to fully fund our work as requested by the agency through its budget and policy option packages. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Rob. And, you know, all of that travel, I think of the strain that it puts on your family, your kids. I know that you've got kids as well. That must be pretty immense. So in addition to your spouse being persuasive, she's also very supportive, evidently.
Extremely supportive.
Any questions? Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'd now like to go backward in our slideshow and tell you a little bit about our appellate division. So I think that's about page 31, but let me get us there.
32.
Thank you.
And Nancy, before we get going, as soon as you get teed up, I do have one question for you.
Okay.
So can you tell me how the remuneration works on a plea versus going to actual trial? Do you get reimbursed just a flat fee no matter of a trial or a plea bargain?
Chair Shields, members of the committee, we now contract with all contractors statewide other than you saw Tillamook County, where it's a non-contract hourly rate. All other providers are paid a flat rate for a case type. It doesn't matter if the case ends up in a plea or a trial, we pay one flat rate for the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Sitting to my left is Peter Gartman. He is our chief defender. And as you heard yesterday, he will be retiring actually at the end of this month. So we were very fortunate to have him here for one last budget presentation. He really didn't want to miss it. So he will also introduce his successor as we move through this presentation. But with that, Mr. Gartland.
Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peter Gartland. I'm the Chief Defender with the Appellate Division of the Office of Public Defense Services. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about the Appellate Division. I first want to talk about the importance of appellate law. When you have litigation at the trial court level, it's typically between two parties. And so when there's a decision, that decision affects those two parties.
Oh, that's terrible.
And if one of the parties is dissatisfied, they might appeal. And the appeal goes to the Court of Appeals and potentially to the Oregon Supreme Court. And appellate law is different because once a case goes to the Court of Appeals, and if the Court of Appeals issues an opinion, that opinion now not only binds those two parties, but it's instructive and it binds all the courts across the state, you know, the lower courts across the state, and district attorneys and lawyers and the public, in a sense. The public has an idea about what the law is. So appellate law is critical to the explanation, articulation, and credibility of the justice system because there's expressed written opinions describing how cases and issues are to be resolved. So like the U.S. Supreme Court, all the attorneys in this state, the DAs, the prosecutors and the police, they look to Court of Appeals and Supreme Court opinions for guidance with respect to how to conduct themselves. Sorry.
Got it. Sorry.
So now I'll get to the appellate division's role in the appellate system. The appellate division of OPDS is the direct counterpart to the Attorney General's office, and we work with criminal cases, including misdemeanor up to death penalty, parole cases, appeals in DNA cases, juvenile dependency, and termination of parental rights cases. We represent individuals in a very high volume practice before the Oregon appellate courts. We actually represent between 40% and 50% of the Court of Appeals filings. And as you heard yesterday from Chief Justice Ballmer, we also represent a significant portion of the caseload before the Oregon Supreme Court. In addition, on occasion, becoming more frequent, the Oregon Supreme Court has asked us to appear as amicus, which means a friend of the court, to file a brief with the Oregon Supreme Court when they believe they have a case where we're not already on the case, but they believe that the case has systemic importance to typically the criminal justice system. Finally, we are institutional partners with the Department of Justice. So we meet regularly with the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals and the Solicitor General in the Attorney General's office to discuss the appellate system and to identify and help and institute and implement some improvements to make the system work better and more efficiently. As I mentioned, we have a high volume practice. We receive between typically 1,600 and 2,000 case referrals per biennium, per year, excuse me. It's double that for the biennium. And of those, we file typically in a year 1,000 cases. And you may wonder, well, what's the difference? Well, sometimes some of the referrals are not yet ripe for appeal, and there are some different procedural hurdles or requirements before we can even file a notice of appeal in certain kinds of cases. And those are typically the guilty plea cases. When somebody pleads guilty to a crime and they wish to appeal, their appellate rights, the Court of Appeals can, by laws, is limited to reviewing whether or not that sentence was legal. The question about liability, criminal responsibility, is off the table. The Court of Appeals only looks at the legality of the sentence. We also have a juvenile section, and Representative Krieger is not here right now, but he was instrumental in 2007. The 2007 legislature authorized the creation of a juvenile appellate section in our office, and that appellate section now consists of 5 attorneys, and that appellate section litigates juvenile dependency issues and termination of parental rights issues. And that, too, is now a high-volume practice. And I believe that the work group, or the group that kind of was the impetus behind the creation of that unit in our office, I'm happy to report that I think that they've achieved what they wanted to achieve, because that unit has generated a lot of opinions from the Court of Appeals. And before their creation, the Court of Appeals typically issued around 10 cases a year, maximum. Now it has issued 20 and 30 opinions per year. And what that has done is exactly what it was designed to do, and that is to give instruction to the courts statewide, the trial courts, and Department of Human Services and the attorneys, and it gives direction with respect to how to implement, how to apply the juvenile code in dependency cases and termination of parental rights cases. So we see a lot more consistency in the application of the law and statewide practice in that area. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how we work internally. We have a lot, I believe, we have a structure that we've developed over the last decade or so that we think provides a lot of quality control and quality assurance over the product that our office is producing. Initially, when we hire someone, we give that, we give this intense management investment of time and instruction. So we have a series of 2-3 month training periods from a manager, could be me or a chief deputy, and for 3 months we'll meet with that person on a regular basis every week to see how they're progressing, to talk about cases and to bring them along, help them learn the craft of appellate law, because appellate law is a specialty area. Even after that 6 month period, every attorney in the office is on a team, and the team meets regularly once a week, and it's guided by a team leader, and it typically consists of 5 to 8 attorneys on the team with varying levels of experience, and they discuss their cases, discuss their issues, and discuss how best, you know, what the merit of the cases are and how best to approach them and brief them. We also have a graduated editing scheme. What I mean by that is we will informally rate the cases internally and decide which cases have the most prospect of success and which are likely not going to have much success, provide relief for the client, and so we graduate the kind of editing that goes into every brief. We'll have the more experienced people edit the briefs that truly have pose merit, high likelihood of success on appeal. We also have a desktop practice manual for our attorneys. I think that's relatively unique. I don't know of any other offices that have that, but it's about a 170-page guidebook, a reference source that identifies how we work as an office. And so it's the first reference that an attorney will go to figure out what to do next on with respect to what the office policy is and what the practices are. We also have regular performance evaluations. We give regular feedback to the attorneys. Every brief that leaves the office has been edited by somebody else, so the attorney receives feedback from their writing. There's feedback from an experienced attorney to every attorney who argues. So after every argument, an attorney who has argued will get some critique from their supervising attorney. We have a 6-month meeting between the team leader and every attorney on that attorney's team, and we have written performance evaluations by management on a yearly basis for employees who have been with the office up to 5 years, and then biannually thereafter for attorneys who have become more senior attorneys in the office. Some of the challenges that we face as a division, one is perennial now is retaining trained attorneys. What we've found is this is a specialty area, and typically it takes up to 5 years before you get an attorney who's very mature, comfortable, seasoned, and is functioning efficiently. And so that and what happens, what we found is typically that's when attorneys look elsewhere. And now they're desirable. Other firms want to hire that person because that person has experience and they know that they're well trained.
Senator Winters.
Over the last 5 years, what's the turnover rate?
We lose around a little over two attorneys per year. So last 2 years we lost 6. That was a little bit high. But we've lost 28 attorneys since 2003. And the reason why that's important for our how that's important for our office is that we do invest a lot in the new people, the new hires, because we want them to get up to speed as quickly as possible. And so whenever we take somebody in, we're looking at 6 months of one-on-one training, which is several hours a week, from management for the new hire, for the new attorney.
Have you thought of any incentives to retain them for longer than the period in which they stay? And I raise this because we're talking about not only the retention for attorneys in your area, but, you know, where we have a scarcity of skill, let's say like physicians and whatever in our rural communities. And I think we're all trying to figure out how we actually are able to actually retain the experienced disciplines that we need. So,
yes, Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, we have tried to address that. There are a couple of factors that are important, and one, of course, sorry to say, is salary. We have been and continue to be typically, you know, historically not compensated at the same rate as our direct counterparts in the Attorney General's office. And it's kind of a difficult rationale. I don't quite understand the rationale how that can be, but that is the state of affairs.
Well, I guess my question then is, when you say that you're losing them, how many are you losing to the Attorney General's office, and how many are going into the private sector? Those numbers, the two per year or whatever.
So. Co-Chair Shields and Senator Winters, we have not lost anyone directly to the Department of Justice. Our attorneys, when they depart, several have retired, but a couple have moved out of state, but most of them go into private practice after they leave us. Another challenge is providing timely, and by the way, there is a policy option package attached to the budget, and that is for a parity between our office, the attorneys in our office, of all the employees in our office, and the Attorney General's office. It's a policy option package 105, and I think right now the cost is about $775,000.
I follow up, Mr. Chair, so that I think that question would be that whether or not that the Department of Justice is, if they're having the same problem that you're having with some of their attorneys leaving, going to the private sector or not. Just, and that's something for us to probably look at this on this panel.
Co-Chair, Senator Winters, I cannot speak to that. I don't know if they're having the same issue.
I know that Mr. Bender's probably jotting it down.
And Peter, your employees are not represented. DOJs are represented. Is that correct?
Right. Well, yeah, that's correct. Co-Chair Shields, actually, our attorneys have just unionized within the last 8 months. That's a new development at the office.
Interesting. Okay, thank you.
That's good news.
I'm going to take these out of order a little bit. Another challenge is providing effective support to the trial bar. Our attorneys appear at continuing legal education seminars regularly, and we field questions from the trial bar regularly. But it's actually really beneficial because we're an institutional presence, and what's happened more and more is the trial attorneys are looking to us as a resource, and we're able to provide assistance and memorandums or advice. And hopefully that'll obviate some of the issues so that they never become appellate issues if they can be addressed at the trial court level. The last one kind of leads into the next screen, and that is key performance measures. And one of the real challenge for us has been historically is providing timely appellate representation. And I'm happy to report that historically we have certainly achieved, we've closed the gap, we've reduced the time it takes to file the appellate brief. And what the key performance measure for our office, for the appellate division, is the median time for filing the appellate brief. And for us, our KPM, our key performance measure, was 210 days. And that means that by day 210, after somebody has been sentenced and the record has settled, that we have filed the brief in at least half the cases. So we want to get half the cases briefed by 210 days. Now, historically, like I said, we were very delayed years ago. In 2006, our median filing date was 328 days, which meant that somebody was waiting almost a year before their appellate brief was filed. Our median filing date now is 227 days. Now, that's an improvement, but unfortunately for us, we have been trending. We've been static for the last couple of 2 years. And I can tell you what I think of the causes of that. As I mentioned before, appellate practice is a fairly specialized practice, and it takes a long time to have attorneys get up to speed where they're fully independent, mature, seasoned attorneys. And we have 40% of our office has less than 40% experience, so we have a very young group. And we provide them a lot of support, but still, as a young group, they're typically not as effective and efficient with respect to addressing caseloads. But they are certainly doing very well, but it's just a factor of the age group in our office. And that's all I have, unless the committee has other questions.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the question of parity between the Attorney General's office and the appellate office. What do you think accounts for the difference? $775,000 is a pretty wide gap. So are you willing to venture some reasons for that?
Sure. Co-Chair Shields and Senator Gorsuch, we have closed a gap over the years, but mm-hmm. there is still a gap. And I historically, quite frankly, it's hard to understand. Hard to understand why, but I think there has just been an historic bias in favor of the Attorney General's office. Most programs, at least that existed 20 years ago, were about police officers and prosecutors, you know, doing good. It's very difficult to explain because you have government attorneys on the same side of the same case, and for us, it's institutional. Mm-hmm. We argue, you know, hundreds of cases a year with the Attorney General on the other side, and yet there's one side that's paid disproportionately higher than the other, and it's hard to explain.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was at a doctor's appointment yesterday, so I wasn't here, but I assume we have a similar problem when we're not talking about the appellate division, but we're just talking about public defenders versus district attorneys. How's that? I see a lot of nods.
Co-Chair Shields and Representative Gorsuch, you will hear more about that today.
Okay.
And it is a chronic problem at both the trial and the appellate court level. And I would venture a guess that it's also partially related to the fact that the right to counsel emerged 50 years ago, and they were pulling lawyers out of the back of courtrooms to provide representation
right.
for free. And so it's part of a developing situation around the country, really. We're not unique in this
right.
circumstance. And so I wouldn't want to paint the picture that Oregon is different than other mm. states in this regard. It is fairly common, even if it is an area where we still need to make some improvements.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Well, I'd just like to say, if I may just hazard a comment, that if we truly believe in equal protection under the law, and if we truly believe in everyone getting due process, and I know it's a national problem, I think this points out that maybe we don't fully support that. So just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Winters.
Just to follow up on that same theme, because we have people that listen in who may or may not have the same level of knowledge and understanding that we do. One, you're talking about a political entity, because if I look at what happens in particularly the district attorneys and what have you, they're paid by the state, plus some of them are also are in the budgets of their respective counties and based on their counties as to how much they actually contribute to their district attorneys. So that is that variable out there, and you know, recognizing that the also the Attorney General's office is, you know, another elected body. So there are some variables that I think that exist when we start talking about some of those particular issues. The particular one is the district attorneys, mm-hmm. where you've got a differential, even across the state and counties itself. I suspect that, you know, when you look at Multnomah County and, you know, versus Malheur County, you're going to see a dramatic wage difference between those two.
All right, one last comment, and then we've got to get on to public.
The only thing I would say to that, and thank you, Senator Winters, the only thing I would say to that is that I don't think there's an expectation, though, that people in Multnomah County make the same as Malheur County. I would say, though, that if you have a county where the DA makes a particular wage, that the public defender should make this a similar wage. And if it's not done because of certain political issues, perhaps the legislature should see to it that that is done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. I will yield my time then for the rest of today to the invited guests and public testimony. So okay. I think we'll get to the slide.
Do you want us to go in order on the agenda, Nancy?
What's their average
judge?
We can.
Let's just do that.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you very much, Director.
Yeah.
All right. Welcome, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. My name
is. Could we leave that up there? Would that be all right? Just so that everybody knows who's next.
My name is Robert C. Lander. I'm a senior judge with the state of Oregon, having retired after 21 and a half years on the Clackamas County Circuit Court, which is the 5th Judicial District. I am testifying on my own behalf and not as a representative of the Judicial Department. I currently serve as the executive director of the Yamhill County Justice Alliance Center, which is a consortium of public defense attorneys who provide criminal and juvenile representation in Yamhill County. The focus of my testimony today is on the representation of parents and children in juvenile court cases within the county. The parent-child representation program, and I understand you heard much about it yesterday, the PCRP, began in Yamhill County in August of 2014. The PCRP has changed the contracting model for juvenile cases within the county, and as a result, juvenile court practice has changed. The PCRP limits the number of juvenile cases an attorney can have to a full-time caseload of 80 cases. Each attorney is required to have a staff person available to respond to clients into the court, and it requires the attorneys to adhere to the Oregon State Bar performance standards for representation and imposes strict oversight requirements. Manageable caseloads for attorneys representing mothers and fathers and children in the juvenile court system allows the attorneys to more efficiently and effectively resolve the cases involving children who have become wards of the court due to abuse or neglect. An attorney is able to establish and maintain a meaningful relationship with the client by engaging with the client early in the case, continuing to communicate regularly with the client throughout the life of the case. According to Mimi Laver, Director of the Legal Education at the ABA Center on Children and the Law, there's a growing body of data which shows that when parents represented by attorneys who have reasonable caseloads and have the availability to spend time with clients between court hearings, the parents have better experience with the child welfare system, and this means that their children experience more positive outcomes. In Yamhill County, prior to the PCRP, attorneys had caseloads close to 100 cases per full-time attorney. As a result of high caseloads, attorneys were not consistently present at shelter hearings and often did not meet with their clients until more than a week had gone on in the case. The parents attended the shelter hearings, the preliminary hearing in the case, which occurs within 24 hours of removal without legal representation. And the children and clients were without an advocate during the initial, often traumatic portion of the case. As a result of the PCRP, attorneys now represent parents and children at all shelter hearings and are required to meet with clients within 72 hours of appointment. Early engagement by parents within the juvenile court case is critical to reunification because the direction that a case takes often is predicted or can be predicted because of what happens in the first few weeks of the case, and that is whether a child is going to be returned home. Because the attorneys have reduced caseloads, they're able to adequately and independently investigate the evidence in each case, including obtaining information, research, and discovery in order to prepare the case for trials and hearings. And I must confess to you, I have not tried a case since I went on the bench in 1988. And I view this program not so much as an attorney representing other attorneys, but as a judge. And I know as a judge that we are expected to make competent decisions based on competent evidence presented to us. But historically, in dependency cases, all of that evidence was filtered through the state. And as well-meaning as the state may be, defense attorneys were forced to react. This program that's been established in Yamhill County means the attorneys can become proactive, make positive proposals which involve the families and have more positive results. So over the past 6 months, the practice of juvenile law in Yamhill County has evolved, and the parents and children in the juvenile court system are the beneficiaries of the changes. Initial results show the cases are resolved more efficiently. Clients have regular opportunities for engagement throughout the life of the case to have time with their attorneys, and the attorneys have the time and the resources to become more effective advocates. I fully suspect when this preliminary program is done, you're going to find the cases are resolved more quickly, and the children are returning to their home more quickly when it's appropriate, which benefits everybody. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Krieger.
Excuse me a second. I'm writing something down here. Judge Brewer had contacted me about a year ago and asked to reconstitute the legislative dependency work group. Both of our senators have been involved in this issue, and our new governor has practiced that law, worked on the original work group, and I think it's going to be a great island. I find most of the people in this room, Judge, don't know our prior relationship. And here, I imagine it's 40 years, and you are coming to this committee with something that I've been working on for 15 years as a legislator, and it does me great good to hear what you're saying. All of us want to make sure that the children are properly represented and the families, because if without that competent, knowledgeable attorney, bad things happen to kids and families. And if you want to do a disclaimer about what I call our prior life, that would be all right.
Co-Chair Shields, member of the committee, representing Representative Krieger. We met, I think I went to Gold Beach in 1972. I was a district attorney. Representative Krieger was with the Oregon State Police. I don't think you would find a more vigorous or prosecution-oriented state policeman than Representative Krieger. And I don't think you would find a more vigorous prosecutor than I was. And I think that we both believed at the time what we were doing was the best that could be done. I think we've aged and we've matured. And I think we've both come to the same conclusion that the more participation we can have, not on the part of the state, but on the part of the defense, the more eyes we can have, the more souls we can get involved, the better the system becomes, particularly in the area of juvenile law. That also applies to adult prosecution as well. But it's been a pleasure to know Representative Krieger for all these years and to see the changes we've both gone through. If you'd forecast ahead, I don't think we would have seen where we are today.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Any questions? All right. District Attorney Beglow, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me here today. Co-Chair Shields, Senator Winters, and members of the committee, my name is Walt Beglaw, and I have the privilege of serving as the Marion County District Attorney. Honestly, I'm not much of a trial attorney anymore, but I have to tell you that I do manage a medium-sized public sector law firm and have done so for just over 10 years now. On behalf of my office and the Oregon District Attorneys Association, I'd like to extend our support of defense services in Oregon. Bottom line, they provide indispensable and essential representation within our public safety system. They are vital in that they need to have sustainable, long-term support in the sense of equal footing for prosecution and defense alike. And I feel very strongly about that. The best work that we do is when you have equal partners in the courtroom in front of the judge making justice happen. Mm-hmm. The main reason I'm here today, and I'm glad that I came as soon as I did to hear a little bit about the debt load, the conversation about pay equity, is that I share some of those concerns. And I would suggest that a market-based salary benefit equity are a very important budget considerations for our legislature. And as I thought through this, I thought of three important perspectives that I thought I'd share from you from my angle as an elected official who runs a law office. The first perspective is from an administrative and organizational one. When I look at our office, it's imperative that from a recruitment and retention perspective, we have healthy salaries and good benefits to honor our employees. The concept of employee advancement is essential as I think of our team and as they move the ranks within our organization. And just as an investment, I heard that here today, in terms of training and what you put into bringing forward young people into very effective attorneys on both sides of the aisle, particularly with Measure 11 and more significant criminal and complex cases. That perspective is extremely important when I wear that hat as an administrator. The second one is from a services delivery perspective and a relational one. The continuity of personnel and experience translates into good, effective work, productivity, and just results. And we see that day to day with the 30-some prosecutors that we have within our office. And thirdly, within that section, is just having good interactions with the defense services within our community. If they're there, they feel respected, they have a good place in their organization, they work better with our people, and we come to better results. It's a very relational business, as you know. And so I think that the services delivery is a critical component. And finally, the personal side of this. People who go into this work have a lot of pride, and you can impact morale if you're just not paying them what they're earning. And I have to tell you that defense attorneys in our community and communities across Oregon work just as hard in the trenches as deputy district attorneys. It's difficult work. It's emotional work. And no one does better at reminding us every day than a defense attorney in our community the human side of the work that they do, because they have that direct connection to it. So I think to create a healthy and working environment, those are why I would support looking at pay equity and why it has to be on equal footing. So again, thank you for having me here today.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. District Attorney. Any questions? All right, Senator Winters.
I'd just like to thank my Mr. District Attorney, and of course he knows, and I had the opportunity last night to where he and Senator Bates and I and Sheriff Myers met, and truly, and they know how I feel about them, because truly in this county we do look at the issue as in its totality rather than in silos, and I'm fond of saying in this building that I probably have one of the best collaborative and working together counties in the state. And I do want to thank, you know, whether it's the defense attorney, whether it's my district attorney, whether it's my sheriff or my chief of police, and the social service community that have to wrap around to those services to make it work. You know, we face a lot of problems and issues in this building, and I put it on the record that I'm very, very supportive of the work that's being done in this county. So when I hear my district attorney talk about coming here to support the defense side of the work, it says a lot about not only him, but what goes on and how we view the work that needs to be done in the not only public safety arena and the social service arena, but the appellate arena and that makes our systems work. So thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krieger.
I would like, well, sometime to have you come in and visit. What I heard you say today about the defense, I think means something to me and some of the other people. We've been looking at Measure 11 and the plea bargain situation and the difficulty in my mind, and I'm an ex-cop, of the defense to really put up the proper plea for the client. Sometime I'd like to talk to you about that.
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Krieger, I'd be pleased to have that conversation. I think we always need to be talking about sentencing and the challenges it brings into the courtroom from both perspectives.
Representative Barker.
And they talked, speaking of the turnover, it was my experience, at least as my, and when I was a policeman, that I would go in to see Deputy District Attorney Jones and they'd say, oh no, he's moved on up to private practice. So is that also not a common occurrence to the deputy district attorneys that they are young lawyers coming in at lower salaries, not as low as the public defenders, and they too move on? Experience that same.
Co-Chair Shields, Representative Barker, that's exactly correct. We deal with the very same challenges of retention and of recruitment, particularly at a management level. But I would be candid in letting you know that our county and other counties, that's where deputy DAs derive their salary, county-based general fund. We've done better. And in fact, in our office, we just got a recent, after doing a market study, an elevation of salaries for our entry-level, mid-level, and senior prosecutors and managers. So we're ahead of the curve. And so that dynamic helps us kind of keep some of those talented young people longer.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Senator Bates, and then we're going to have
just
to move
quick.
On.
Good Senator Winters said a lot of nice things about you because she has to. You're in her district, but I don't have to.
Look out.
And,
I'm ready.
Last night's dinner was really great. And, you know, if you're doing half the job and the rest of this, you're doing taking care of the mentally ill and people with drug and alcohol problems and keep them out of the state hospital and keep them out of jail, then my hat's off to you. And I'm hoping the programs you've set up here in the last 10 or 15 years can be spread across the state. I was really impressed. You guys are doing a great job.
Co-Chair Shields, Senator Bates, it's a team effort, but we are very pleased with what we're seeing. So thank you for those comments and for to you as well, Senator Winters. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. All right, could we bring up Angela Sherbo and Tom Cermak. And if we have room for three up there, I can't see how many chairs are there. Tom Crabtree. You don't look like Angela Sherbo.
I am not Angela Sherbo.
I think we need to understand that more, too.
Never will be.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. And as you pointed out, I am not Angela Sherbo. I'm here as a poor substitute for her today. The fact is that she had clients with very important matters that demanded her attention, and I think that is testimony in and of itself that she couldn't make it today because she's attending to her clients' needs. I think most of you know, but just briefly, Youth Rights and Justice has operated as a nonprofit public defense organization for 40 years in Portland. Started it in 1975, and we represent clients in juvenile dependency cases, both children and parents, juvenile delinquency cases, appellate cases of both of those types, dependency and delinquency, and we represent the youth who are under the jurisdiction of the Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board. Since Judge Sealander did such a nice job of teeing up the importance of the juvenile dependency representation, I'm not going to repeat the points that he already made, and I would like to instead talk about numbers. In the agency's presentation on pages 18 and 19, you see two graphs. The first graph shows how the caseload is divided among public defense, and you'll see that a big slice, 35%, is juvenile dependency and delinquency cases. The problem comes, an additional problem, besides what you've already heard about today, is that when you look at the next slide, you see that expenditures by case type, only 16% go to juvenile dependency and delinquency cases. 35% of the caseload versus 16% of the expenditures. And again, consistent with the conversation that has occurred today, it's hard to explain such a disparity, except that that disparity probably goes back decades to when the state first assumed responsibility for public defense and probably existed before that. And the budget process that occurs every 2 years has simply institutionalized that disparity over time. And it's not a disparity that the Office of Public Defense can correct on their own. As you've heard, all aspects of this work are underfunded. And we wouldn't want to suggest, nor would we, that money be taken away from other case types because we know there's not enough to begin with. But this is an additional disparity. And what it means is that our caseloads are too high. As you heard, the national standards recommend no more than 80 cases, and our attorneys consistently carry more than the maximum recommended amount of cases. And that also results in the kinds of salary disparities that you've heard about. And I think because of that disparity within the disparity for juvenile work, that our compensation disparity is possibly even more acute than some others. And the only page of testimony I've submitted today was this chart comparing at July 1st, 2014, our salary scale for our attorneys versus salary scales for assistant district attorneys in Multnomah County, who we appear with on the same cases. And you can see that our attorneys, that in the district attorney's office, they make 40% more right off the bat, the starting salary. One of our attorneys doesn't get to that level until they've worked for 10 years. But after 10 years, or after 9 years, a district attorney with the same amount of experience makes 51% more. And then by year 17, an assistant district attorney makes more than double what one of our attorneys makes. And the cumulative difference over this time is $744,000 in salary. As you've heard, these cases take expertise, time, and hard work. So recruiting qualified people, retaining them, and giving them workloads that they can manage is critical to success for our clients. I think it's somewhat unfortunate that this conversation doesn't occur across the silos of human services and public safety, because one of the most important lessons learned in Washington State through their pilot project is that by investing resources on the public defense side to provide good representation to parents in that case results in better outcomes for those families, children spending less time in foster care, more likely to be adopted or go into guardianship and arrive more quickly, and therefore save the state money on the child welfare side.
Just a comment, I don't think it that particular issue did not pass the thought and mind of, I know, these two senators and I'm sure that others on this panel, that you are correct, and I think we're having some side conversations about DHS, public safety, and the defense, all that need to be having further this conversation on the juvenile dependency. I know that Rep. Krieger and some of us have been extremely interested over time as to how we actually do a much better job. So we didn't miss that point yesterday.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Winters. I appreciate it. So within this silo, obviously, the policy option packages 101 to help narrow the gap between district attorney salaries and our attorney salaries is very important, as well as the juvenile dependency policy option package that would expand the kind of representation that Judge Sealander described as currently occurring in Lynn and Yamhill counties to additional counties. And certainly we understand that larger counties are more expensive, but larger counties on a pilot basis also offer both unique challenges and opportunities that can't be addressed by a pilot in a small county. And in addition, the reason that larger counties cost more money is because that is where the most children and the most families are going to be impacted, and investing a larger amount of money will benefit more people. And with that, I'll conclude. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Tom Cermak. I'm the public defender in Marion County. My office has been in existence since 2007. We provide about 30%. We serve about 30% of the criminally accused in Marion County who qualify for public defenders. The other 70% is by the older and larger organization, Marion County Association of Defenders. My office is the public defender counterpart to Mr. Beglaw's office, as you've probably figured out. I was somewhat envious to hear that he is ahead of the curve, because before I found out he was ahead of the curve, I was aware that he was thousands of dollars ahead per salary paying his employees than I was paying mine. And my guess is that gap has widened. I think we're a little behind the curve in that area. When I started the office in 2007, there were two lawyers, myself and another. We now have 10 lawyers. At that time, I was anticipating that we would have the usual turnover that you get in a public defender or district attorney's office, which is you get young people who don't have much experience, you train them up, they go on into private practice. And that was the model, certainly when I started 30 years ago. And was somewhat still the model, although I may have been a little bit behind the times in 2007. The practice of criminal law has changed, and it continues to change. The technology has made the basic cases more complex. I don't remember the last time I tried a shoplifting case or a robbery 3 case where I didn't have to review and refute evidence on somebody's surveillance camera. We get that all the time. Sometimes, most of the time, it's the parking lot of the Walmart. That complicates the case. It makes the defense, in order to do a competent defense, present a competent defense, we have to review all of that material. Collateral consequences increase. Or United States Supreme Court cases have illustrated that recently. Federal government will take action on drug convictions, for example, that impact driver's licenses and your ability to get education, to get scholarships for education. All of this impacts our clients. It makes simple cases complex, and as was pointed out with Measure 11 and other Measure 73 and other things that have complicated and increased the penalties for cases, more serious cases have more serious consequences. I typically will put two lawyers on a Measure 11 case in my office because the consequences very frequently are a client will be looking at 25 years in prison. That's virtually a life sentence, and he deserves the vigorous representation of two lawyers and all of the resources that I can throw into that defense. My people are underpaid. I lose people to private practice. I lose people to other public defenders' offices. When I started the office, I had a volunteer from Willamette Law School, and he said, "I will work for nothing to help you find a place to set up shop and get computers, if you will hire me as a clerk." And I said, "Sure, I'll do that." 2 years later, I said I would hire him as a lawyer. I did an interview with him, and I said, "So, you know, what are your career plans?" And he said, "I want your job." And he said, "But only in about 10 years." He was a dedicated public defender. That's what he wanted to do with his career from the middle of law school on. 2 years ago, he came to me and he said, "In a weak moment, I learned of a position at SAFE and to be one of their administrative attorneys. And I applied for the job. I've interviewed. They are offering me $30,000. More than you can pay me." And I lost that dedicated public defender to State Accident Insurance Fund, where he is not as excited about the work that he's doing, but is certainly excited about the fact that he can now pay off his student debt, which is astronomical. I came out of law school with almost no student debt. I have employees who've come out of law school with $100,000 in school debt. Those are the sorts of hurdles that we have now, and they can make more money in private practice than they can in my office. I don't have a problem with recruitment. There are young people coming out of law school today who want to be in public service, and they want to be in criminal defense because they understand the value of a vigorous defense in defending the individual and the Constitution. I do have a problem with retention because they cannot make enough money over the course of their career to satisfy the needs of their family and their obligations. That's why it's important that every time I hear Walt Beglaw say it, I thank him. He's right. You know, we need parity with district attorneys. We do the same work. We work as hard. And I think we are as dedicated to our defense and the achievement of justice as the district attorneys are. Thank you. I'll take any questions, of course.
All right.
Hi, my name is Tom Crabtree. I'm the public defender in Deschutes and Crook counties. Reason we don't have a fancy name like Marion County Public Defender or Metropolitan Public Defender is at the time the state took over funding for indigent defense, they did not have any money that they could give us to change signs, change our letterhead, change our stationery. So we're still Crabtree and Ramsdorf Defense Services. I'm the longest currently serving public defender in the state since 1981. And over that time, I've seen a lot of changes in indigent defense, a lot of changes here in this building with a lot more knowledge of what the system is like, what the problems are. And one of those areas, unfortunately, has been the fact that indigent defense is significantly underfunded. You've heard from a number of people about what those problems are like. In 1981, when we established our office, our salary was within $1,000 of the district attorney's office. Unfortunately, that isn't the case anymore. In the last 15 years, the difference has, increased almost exponentially. In 2000, our salary was within $5,300 of the district attorney's office. At this point, the gap is $18,365 for starting salary. We start at 63, they start at 81,365. The trend line of that is that within the next two budget cycles, the difference will be $24,000 in starting salary. And we can't compete with this, and this does play into our problem of retention and recruitment. Over the last decade, I've lost two attorneys directly to the district attorney's office, and a third went to the district attorney's office after a short time out of our office. One of my colleagues, Jacques DeKalb, who has a law firm that does a large portion of their business is indigent defense, just lost one of his young associates to the district attorney's office because she can make, you know, $20,000 more a year for doing the same kind of work and doing less of it. Found out yesterday that the district attorney has a new opening, and so we're both holding our breaths and hoping we aren't raided again to provide young attorneys for them. It's not only unfortunate, there's something wrong when a beginning district attorney fresh out of law school can make more money than an attorney handling Measure 11 cases in our office, that it takes someone 7 years to get to the starting salary of the district attorney in our office at this point. And so we have our attorneys that are doing Measure 11 cases that are paid less than somebody who's doing their first shoplifting case for the DA's office. Over the last decade, our office has lost 19 attorneys. As I said, two of those were directly into the district attorney's office. But of those, 13 were directly related to financial issues. Others were related to workload, and in a couple of instances, family-related situations. But it's becoming an increasing problem, and is we all know, too, that coming out of the recession, housing is getting more expensive. And my attorneys with extensive student loan debt are finding it difficult to find housing that they can afford, that when, you know, the median price of a home in Bend is over $300,000 a year now, and with their salaries, they can only qualify for $230,000. The only way that we had been able to attempt to compete with the DA's office and raise salaries is playing the numbers game, that when the state took over, Bill Linden was the state court administrator and in charge of managing the indigent defense system. Our first contract, we were paid a total of $365 a case. But after that, he had indicated that if you want any more money, you have to agree to do more cases. So we started in 1985 with 181 cases per attorney per year. We are now at 330 cases per attorney per year. That $365 a case back in 1985, adjusted for inflation, would amount to $804.59 a case, according to the CPI inflation index.
Tom, could I interrupt you real briefly? We do have a number of people we still have to get to. Would you mind summarizing for
us so we can? Sure. So basically what I'm saying is that we are paid at this point 72% of what we were paid in 1985. But adjusted for workload, we are paid now at 39% of what we were getting back in 1985. That the policy option packages you see before you are not an option. They are a necessity for us in order to provide quality representation, to continue to provide representation for people across the board, and to not have the indigent defense system turn into another crisis having to be dealt with down the road. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. All right, we've got about, We're not gaveling out. I'm just trying to make some decisions about who should go and who should not. And I think I will go with
Chair, if I might. We have a
Jennifer
yeah.
McGowan and and Ms. Waters. So let's bring them up first. And generally, if you are in the building on a regular basis, I might ask you to come back tomorrow. Would that be all right, Joe and Aaron?
Thank you, Co-Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer McGowan. I'm a staff attorney at Youth Rights and Justice. You already heard from our executive director, Mark McKechnie. I was going to talk a little bit about my own experience and my own practice. I think the committee has a good understanding of what an attorney at Youth Rights and Justice does. I do both dependency and delinquency law and all that that entails. I think, you know, as I listen to the testimony today, I feel like a walking example of all of the issues that are before the committee today. I have high student loan debt. I am very dedicated to the practice of public defense. I went to law school to do this work. I've been there since 2003. And when I graduated from law school with honors, everybody wanted to tell me, well, that means you can get a job that pays you much better than public defense. Really? You sure that's still where you want to go? And I had all sorts of people kind of coming up to me saying, wow, there's a lot of options before you now. There wasn't an option for me. I knew what I wanted to do. I was dedicated to it. And I went ahead and have made that commitment. But throughout the years, I won't say that there haven't been opportunities and times when I've looked at that salary for another job and wondered what a difference it could make to myself and my family. I have two young children and a husband. And when I hear Mark McKechnie talking about the lifetime difference in salary, it is disheartening because I think that, you know, the work we do is complex. It's hard work, but it's very important work. And on that note, I'm pleased to be here with somebody way more important than me. This is Shatira Waters. She's a former client of mine. I started representing her when she was 15 years old, and I represented her until she turned 21 and aged out of the foster care system. And when we first started working together, she was angry at times. She didn't trust the system very much. She had been in foster care since she was 8 years old. She'd been in a lot of different foster homes. And we were able to, I think, secure some really lovely outcomes in her case, one of which was to push DHS through the use of the court system to have her placed with a family member. There was a lot of objection at that time to that placement. And that allowed her some real stability in the system. It allowed her a home where she could age out of, and she wasn't bouncing around from home to home. We were also able to do a lot of future planning and a lot of work to make sure that when she aged out of foster care, she had an education and she had some goals and objectives to go through. I'm pleased to say she's currently at Mount Hood Community College. She got a 4.0 last term, and she's working hard to, you know, kind of secure her dream for her future. And so I'm going to turn it over to her so that she can talk a little bit about her experience working with an attorney and what a difference it made in her life.
Ms. Waters, welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Thank you, guys. It's an honor to be here. Jennifer has...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Shatira Waters. Jennifer has... I'm going to try not to cry because it's a topic I don't like to get on foster care. But I'll be 28 years old, and I still have a relationship with Jennifer. It's just... She really cared. And being in foster care, you don't think nobody cares. And so Jennifer did go out her way a lot of times for me. So I didn't really write down what to say, but I love Jennifer. I have had like 20 case managers. I don't have any relationships with none of them. I don't care too much for none of them. Jennifer always made me feel special. Jennifer played more. She was my mentor, a shoulder to cry on. It's just, I know, I could just imagine having a caseload just from being on low income with my social workers and how they treat us. And Jennifer always made me feel special, always made time for me. I can call her to this day. And I've been out of foster care almost a decade. So I love Jennifer, and I hope that every attorney is like Jennifer. And foster kids, we need somebody to speak for us, because a lot of people don't speak for us. They don't understand where we come from. And it's hard being a foster care. You angry when you're a foster child, and nobody having people, the state feel like they never want to fight for you. And having Jennifer to be a voice for me when I feel like I didn't have a voice, that meant a lot to me. I still, to this day, am able to have Jennifer as a mentor. She's helping me look for jobs. I can call her and talk about my kids' personal life. So I just really care for Jennifer, and she is a good person. And her job, and I don't know really too much about her job, but as our relationship, we have a good relationship, and I'm happy that I have met her. She's probably the only thing that the foster system have done for me, I feel, that came good out of foster care, is Jennifer. So thank you, guys.
Well said. Thank you very much. It really puts an important perspective into the record. And congratulations on all your success. We're rooting for you.
Thank you.
All right. So, Nancy, I will let you give us direction on who you would really like to testify. I can stick around for maybe another 10 minutes, but I think we're going to start losing committee members in five.
We have three Lane County folks here, if we could do that.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Oh, thank you very much. My name is Rosalind Lee. I'm an attorney in private practice in Eugene. I'm a member of the Lane County Defense Consortium. I've been an attorney for 18 years. I've been in private practice most of that time. However, it's always been my privilege to represent people who are accused of crimes and cannot afford to pay for their attorneys. What I've provided to the committee, and I think is going to be handed out just now, what I provided is kind of a real-life example of what it means to take court-appointed cases as a member of a consortium here in Oregon. I have taken court-appointed cases. I was a California attorney for 9 years, and I represented people there. My husband is an Oregon native, so I'm not just didn't just come walking up here. But I did take court-appointed cases in California. I am a member of the Criminal Justice Act panel. I take them in federal court. I also have a robust private practice. The sample, so what I did is, just so that the committee can see, I made a sample budget of basically what it takes to run a law office if you are a consortium member. I'm just going to highlight some points to it. I vetted this with the head of my consortium and with my office assistant for accuracy and reasonableness. I think this is the basic of what you really need to have in order to run a law office within the rules of the Oregon State Bar and within the terms of our contracts. And I am essentially a subcontractor. I don't do the big policy things. I accepted appointments to represent individuals. So you start out, you need an office. There's your rent. It's that's a lowball figure. That is subletting an office in a suite. And so this is something where you're necessarily already sharing resources with other people. You have to have a legal assistant according to our contracts. And because indigent defense is necessarily high volume, you are not in the office a lot if you are a trial attorney. You are in court a lot. You're at the jail a lot. You're in meetings a lot. And then you're on the phone a lot. Any kind of real legal work happens at night and on the weekends. That's how you get the rest of your actual work done. You need a legal assistant. Again, I'm assuming that you will share that person. $15 an hour, and then I added 11% for the employer side taxes. So that's $15,000 a year. And that's not being a very good boss. That's no benefits or anything. That's just paying someone a reasonable hourly wage. There's bar dues, the three different types of insurance that you need to pay for, your PLF premium, and there's no change in your PLF premium based on what kind of law you practice. We all pay the same. So if you're in a practice where we don't get sued very often, we are actually subsidizing the lawyers who get sued all the time. So that's a fixed cost. We must have premises liability under our contract. And then health insurance is now mandated by law. If you're young enough to think you could go without health insurance, that's no longer the case. And that's, again, for a single person. If you are the primary breadwinner, then you're going to be paying more for your family. But again, this is just for one person, and what doesn't reflect is that if you're buying insurance on the open market as a small businesswoman, all of these cases, particularly since the Affordable Care Act, the premiums are pretty reasonable, but they have very large out-of-pocket costs. So if you actually have to use your health insurance, you're looking at a very high out-of-pocket cost. And again, you have a corporate form, so you have the Secretary of State fee, which isn't very much, but it all adds up. And then just your basic cell phone, a bookkeeper, again, part-time that you're sharing with other people, copying your computers. These are all just the basic needs that you have to run a practice, and it adds up to $43,600 a year. I need to earn that much money every year before I can get paid. And I have an obligation. I have an obligation to the person from whom I rent my space and to my employees and the people I hire to do the work. I have to pay them first. So off the top, I need to make $43,000. And what else is missing from here is that it's my compensation, and there's no retirement, certainly. I have to figure out how to retire, which is extraordinarily challenging. Anybody who has a small business will tell you that, how hard it is to plan for retirement and put that money away. Because these are business expenses and Schedule Cs, I don't have to pay taxes on this income, so I only have to pay taxes on what I pay myself, really. But what this budget doesn't reflect, and which is part of just living life, and why it's impossible, I found, to be a consortium lawyer under these rates, is that there can be no emergencies. There's nothing in this that will allow me to have an emergency. And as a human being and as an adult in this society, there are essentially two types of emergencies we deal with, one of which is a medical emergency. One of the members of the consortium in Lane County got pneumonia last year. And so what does that mean? A large out-of-pocket expenditure, and then you're not accepting new appointments, and so you're not getting any new money in every month, and then you're not working on the cases that you do have. And so the criminal dockets are very, very fast, and they're much – you tell a civil attorney how quickly we have to go to trial, and it's shocking to them. So all of a sudden you have no income. If you're running a practice that's mostly or entirely court-appointed cases, you have zero income. And so now all of a sudden you're behind, and for the primary breadwinner, there's no safety net. The other emergency that we have as lawyers is that it's a professional emergency. And what happens, and is what happens to me, and I want to briefly share with you, this is why I had to stop taking appointments. And it's always been my privilege to take these appointments, and I'm really sad that I'm not doing this work right now. I had three cases, a probation violation that required us to litigate an open question of constitutional law in the state of Oregon, exclusive to probation violations, where we ended up going to the Oregon Supreme Court on an extraordinary writ by the Attorney General. That was for a probation violation. Our payment is for a single probation violation is $125. And doing the extraordinary writs is included in the contract. So that's not something that I would be eligible to ask for additional money for, because it is part of our contract. At the same time, I had another case where the client had the evidence was in 200 boxes of documents being stored at the police department, where my access was I had to go to the police department and read them while the detective sat there. I looked back over my records this morning, and I spent about 80 hours doing that on that case. Also at the same time, I represented a gentleman who was charged with four burglaries. He was already in prison for several other burglaries, actually for a car theft. There were multiple co-defendants. The case for which he was in prison was related to the cases that he was charged with, and it required some fairly unique litigation. All those cases were happening last spring, exactly a year ago. And all of the hearings and the trials were all happening at the same time. That happens all the time to indigent defense lawyers. Everything starts to stack up. But what's different for a consortium lawyer is that I've got to keep the lights on. And I knew, because I've been a lawyer for 18 years, I'm experienced enough to know that I was going to start, if I kept taking appointments in order to keep the lights on, I was going to start making mistakes. And I was going to start shortchanging my clients. that I wasn't going to be, even my calendar was getting loose, even with assistance, because it was just too much work to do. So I stopped taking appointments because I wouldn't have been able to serve the clients that I had, including my private practice, which essentially kind of was funding my indigent defense practice. I couldn't serve my clients, and I couldn't serve my poor clients or the clients who were paying me or my federal clients, and so I had to stop. Because I couldn't rely on this, I couldn't keep taking cases in order to pay my overhead without shortchanging, and at best shortchanging a client, at worst sacrificing justice. And I regret that deeply, and I hope that this committee does recommend an increase in payments, because we just can't do it on these payments to the consortia. So I'll yield my time and answer any questions. Thank you for your attention.
Great. Thank you. Next.
Hi, I'm Sean McRae. I'm the Vice Chair of the Public Defense Services Commission. I've been the Vice Chair since the Commission started in 2000. I've watched our triumphs. I've watched our efforts. I've watched the help that you've given us, and we still need more help. I provided you my testimony in writing. I had a feeling time might grow short. You've heard a lot of important things from a lot of good people. The bottom line, underscoring what Roz has said, what other people have said, is defense lawyers and investigators have got to have enough time to be able to put into the cases what the cases need. And the example that I gave you in my written testimony is a case that honestly scared me to death. Because if I hadn't gone that extra step, if I hadn't found that witness, my client could be doing a ballot measure 11, 7.5-year sentence in prison for a crime that she didn't commit. So please, please keep trying to give us what we need. Let the investigators and the defense lawyers have sufficient money to be able to do their work so everyone gets due process and we provide the justice that I know we want to give in this state. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Greg, welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Shields, committee members, legislative staff. I am Greg Hezer-Abedian. I am the Executive Director of Public Defender Services of Lane County Incorporated, the Public Defender's Office in Eugene, in other words. Just a little bit before that, I represented people charged with aggravated murder facing the death penalty, and prior to that, I was in private practice of criminal defense law. In 1977, a band of young and idealistic lawyers formed the organization I now have the privilege of chairing. One of the people who helped form that organization and who led it with distinguished and honor for over 20 years was Ross Shepard, recently deceased. Many of you know, have had the privilege of knowing Ross. These young lawyers in 1977 were motivated by idealism, not a paycheck. And that's coming home to roost to me right now, because some of these people are starting to retire. Many of them are now in their mid-60s. In the last 3 months, I've had three lawyers from that group announce their retirements. Their tenures at the office were between 25 and 38 years. And what I have found is the sticker shock of what it takes not to replace somebody with that much experience, but what it takes to replace somebody with far less experience, but enough experience to handle that kind of caseload, the 5 to 10 year lawyer. Think about it, if you had a 1977 pickup truck and you had good old trusty White Lightning truck. I used to have a truck called White Lightning. And you had her, since you bought her brand new in 77 for $8,000, and all of a sudden you decided it was time to replace that truck and go out and shop for a new truck. And we all know that if you go shop for a new truck these days, $50,000 is not a crazy amount of money to be told that it costs. So what I'm finding is that I'm having to pay the 5 or 10 year lawyer not very far off what I was paying the 25, 30, 35 year lawyer. What does that tell us? What that tells us is that those lawyers with that amount of time in public defense were donating a lot of money to the state of Oregon. And I don't think there's another generation ready to do that. Those those of us who came out of the 60s or the 70s were motivated by different things than people are today. And I just want to bring home the message that we're not going to find more people willing to donate money to the state of Oregon. And I know that you do what you can with what you have. I'm just trying to emphasize, please do it as quick as you can. Thank you very much for your time. I'd entertain any questions.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate your testimony. I think you all have done a very good job imparting the urgency of this situation to the committee, and I think it has been well received. Nancy, I've got another 5 or 10 minutes. If there's anybody that you feel really can't come back to testify tomorrow that you think we would like to hear, but committee members, if you want to depart, feel free. If you can stick around, that's fine too. I'll make sure they watch the tape if they leave early.
Should I go ahead and start?
Please.
So thank you, Chair Shields. I'm Lane, and member of the committee left. I'm Lane Borg, Executive Director of Metropolitan Public Defenders, and I'm going to try to be really short to give time for these other folks here to talk. I do want to thank you for the policy option package. It was passed 2 years ago that began to answer some of the needs, but there's more that needs to be done, and then we need more money in the system to address systemic issues around that. But the story that Director Cozine asked me to come down and tell you briefly is one that I happened upon, just not my day job, but I actually take cases once in a while as the executive director. I remind my staff that my job is to run the office with 140 staff in 2 counties, but I took some cases, and last summer I took a misdemeanor case. Seemed like an ordinary failure to register as a sex offender. As more I got in the case, I started looking at doing my due diligence as a lawyer and looked for the documents that would justify the conviction, what his prior conviction was that would require registration. And what I noticed was it was a juvenile conviction out of Yamhill County in 1995. Started looking at that, didn't really have a judgment. It had some documents that hinted at that. 95 was not the dark ages. I was practicing law in 1995 and not even as a new lawyer. So I knew that they had to be out there, but I kept looking and kept looking. And to make a long story short, what I determined was the client had been involved in a sexual encounter when he was 14 years old with a 12-year-old child of a family friend. He was interviewed by a detective. Nothing happened. He was living with an aunt at the time. They moved him to a different aunt. About a year and three months later, he got a letter in the mail, said, come to court. He came to court. No lawyer, no DA. He appeared before a judge in Yamhill County and a juvenile court counselor and pled guilty to sodomy 2 and sex abuse 1. Now, that's important to understand. Sodomy 2 can only be committed by non-consent by age. And I asked him, I started talking, I said, did you have a lawyer? He says, no. Did you ever talk to a lawyer? No. Did anybody explain to you that you had a complete defense? He's 26 months older than this victim in the case, and he had a complete defense. But instead of doing that, instead of advising him of that and not convicting him as a juvenile, he got convicted of 2 serious felony sexual offenses as a 16-year-old. And he's now in his mid-30s, and his only contact with the system, he's not turned to a life of crime, his only contact in the system has been some probation violations from that juvenile probation, and 3 arrests for failure to register as a sex offender. One resulted in 2009 in a no complaint, mine in Multnomah County, that we were able to convince a circuit court judge that the conviction was unconstitutional, was not validly sound to be used as an element in the case. And the third one, unfortunately, is pending right now in Yamhill County, and the hearing is yet to happen later this month, so I couldn't risk bringing him here personally. But the thing that I can tell you with absolute certainty is, had he had a lawyer, that lawyer certainly would have seen, you have a defense to this case. He was not guilty of any sex crime, certainly the ones he was convicted of, the sodomy 2 and sex abuse 1, and yet we have ruined his life. And I say we as a system have ruined his life. I asked him, what is the best job you've ever had in 19 years at that point last year when I was representing him? He said he worked in a paint shop for 1 month before they found out he was a sex offender and fired him. Usually he works in a fast food joint for a couple of weeks until they find out he's a sex offender and they fire him. So we're in the process of trying to rectify that. I'm getting the Oregon Innocence Project involved with that. But this underscores the absolute importance of, we just have to have a standard of juveniles should not be allowed to plead guilty to felonies without representation. And so I'd ask you to support the various programs. And I'd answer any questions, but I know I want to give time to the other folks here.
Great. Thank you, Lane, for telling the story.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Co-Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Martz. I am a member of the Portland Defense Consortium. I'm also the president of the board of directors, and I'm a partner in the two-man firm of Bethune & Martz. I've been doing criminal defense my entire career, which is about 26 years. I started out with a contractor, went into private practice, came back and joined the consortium. You've heard descriptions of what the consortiums are and what they do, so I'm not going to add to that. I just want to tell you that the original model was, yes, consortiums can make money on the side. I don't know about a lot of different consortiums. I can talk about ours in Multnomah County. We're in the busiest jurisdiction. Our consortium handles the bulk of the ballot measure 11 offenses. We handle the conflict cases. These are the most difficult cases. These are people that have gone through two and three lawyers. We've gotten calls from judges, would you please take this case? It's extremely difficult. As a result of that, we are basically full-time public defenders now, but we're full-time public defenders who have to run offices. We have to pay PLF. We have to pay bar dues. We have to pay rent. We have to maintain insurance. All of my costs, or all of our costs, have gone up every year. Adjusted for inflation, I've been a member of this consortium now for about three contract cycles. We haven't, in real dollars, we have not seen an increase. We cannot recruit talented lawyers, young lawyers. We've only have, now, due to the structure of our consortium and the type of cases we take, we have to have experienced lawyers. We have to meet certain standards. We're happy to meet those. We think they are extremely necessary. But it's gotten to the point, and you heard one prior lawyer talk about the effect on morale, I believe it was Mr. Beglau. This is having an extreme effect on morale. Our lawyers are hammered. We work nights. We work weekends. I just finished a case that lasted 7 months. It was an assault three. It was a bar fight with two young men that had problems early in their lives, had turned their lives around, maintained employment. And they both said, if we get convicted of this, we're going to get fired. We're going to lose our jobs if we get a felony. It's a very triable case. We spent months on this case. We spent months talking to the prosecutor. As a result of that work, those two men walked out of the courthouse with misdemeanor convictions. They were able to keep their jobs, and instead of taking public money, sitting in a jail, they're working and paying taxes. I had no idea. I don't really pay attention to the contract numbers. And I was told we got $800 for that case. We cannot continue to operate. I can't keep the doors open. We had one of our members, she's one of the only female-headed law firms in our consortium. She had to dip into her own private account to make payroll. We can't keep the doors open. We do this work because we truly believe in it. But that alone is not getting us through. This is becoming a crisis. You heard Chairman Ellis talk about the graying of the defense bar. I'm the graying of the defense bar. The institutional knowledge that we have, it's not just about knowing the law. It's knowing who to call. It's developing relationships with the judges and with the prosecutors. When I go, that goes with me. I want to leave it for somebody. I want to show somebody, here's how you can do this work. We can't do it. We can't hang on to lawyers. When I talk to people coming out of law school, would you be interested in doing this? And I describe the job and what it pays. They look at me, one of them just laughed and said, are you kidding? There's no way we can do this. We need this. We need this desperately. We need to be able to keep up. We need to be able to maintain our morale, because we're not only dealing with things as they are now. We have Measure 57, Measure 73, the Repeat Property Offender Act. Even the most basic cases now become complicated. This is not Marcus Welby. This is a specialized practice. So we're asking for your help. At a minimum, would you please fund POP 101? And we appreciate everything you've done. We hope you can do more.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hi.
I'm terribly sorry. I have another meeting of 5 minutes late for.
I can return tomorrow. I'll make arrangements.
It's up to you. If you wanted to stay and get it on the record, tomorrow. I'd be happy to listen. We got about another 5 minutes if you two want to go.
5 minutes?
I can do it in 2.5, and so
can
Mr. Elliott. All right,
I will stay.
Andrew Kolmetz. I'm a shareholder, Kolmetz, Steen & Hanrahan up in Portland. My firm is one of the members of the Portland Defense Consortium. I'm here to speak in favor of POP 100. I've been involved directly with the provision of indigent defense services as a private contractor since 1997. In that time, I can tell you, I echo everything that's been said here. The contract values per case, have you heard, the value in relative dollars relative to our cost of doing business have been actually going down. The response has been an historic raising of our attorney case levels, and the reasons that we speak out now in favor of POP 100 is, as Mr. Martz pointed out, we have become de facto public defense lawyers. The lawyers in my office who do public defense cases are at least 95% FTE public defense lawyers. There is simply less time to devote either to business development or to the nurturing of and representation in outside cases. Our public defense caseloads take all of our effort, and the caseloads themselves have risen to critical levels. We'd ask that you consider very strongly prioritizing POP 100 to bring us up to parity with other more traditional, perhaps, nonprofit public defense offices. I just want to leave the committee with one number and a question that doesn't need to be answered, but how much is necessary to defend a child faced with a 70 or 90-month mandatory Measure 11? How many attorney hours are appropriate or, at a bottom line, necessary? That one type of case, that one case value is $1,827 in my county for a child facing 70, 90 months in prison. Thank you.
We also underline another issue that the legislature should be taking up.
Good afternoon. If I had 3.5 minutes, I wasn't.
Good afternoon. I'm Andrew Elliott. I'm with Clackamas Indigent Defense Corporation. Clackamas County's only indigent defense is through the CIDC, a consortium. There are about 30 lawyers in that consortium. I'm on the board of that consortium. I'm also the chair of the hiring committee. We have low turnover, but periodically our lawyers become judges or retire. And something I don't think has been touched on is the unique position that puts us in. I think the average tenure in our consortium is about 20 to 30 years. We have a very graying bar, I think is the term that's been bantered about. Which is great for our clients, very, very experienced lawyers. The way we're structured, every one of our lawyers is Measure 11 qualified, and we do everything. So when somebody retires or becomes a judge or moves into private practice, we're looking for lawyers with 5 to 10 years experience. And we get a ton of applicants of lawyers fresh out of law school. But to find that lawyer who wants this job and to explain to them the numbers that were previously shown and say, you're going to run your own firm, you're going to have $50,000 of overhead, and then, you know, you can theoretically, the sky's the limit, right? You can take private practice, but by the way, you're going to be in court 5 days a week for this. Realistically, we're offering them a $50,000 job. It's very difficult to find qualified people to take that position. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Dr. Bates, I appreciate you hanging in there. I didn't want to compound your workflow problems by making you come back a second day, if at all possible. So I appreciate you, Dr. Bates, hanging in there. I just wanted to let you know that I think I speak for co-chair Williamson and when we appreciate the work that you're doing. And I think it was Robert Kennedy Jr. in Amicus Brief in Gidgen versus Wainwright who said, the poor man accused of crime has no lobby. And I think, except for us, we should fight and work into our budget a way to make sure that we at least get close to having equal justice. And I appreciate you guys being on the front lines. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Front lines. This meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.